We find ourselves this week again in Matthew chapter 5, which is the opening to what is often known as a Sermon on the Mount. Probably more accurate, you should call it the teaching on the hillside. But this sermon, this teaching, forms the foundation of everything Yeshua wanted to teach. It's at the very heart and core, the foundation of everything he wanted to impart to us. And so many times in churches and in messianic congregations, as you talk to believers, you'd think that what he was trying to emphasize in lives was something different from this. But this is what was on his heart to teach his people. And if we really want to know what the heartbeat of Messiah was, it's found in Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7. Of course, everything else, but this is the core. This is right at the very center. And so as we go through the Sermon on the Mount, and we will really camp out at these three chapters for quite a while, because I think there's so much we've overlooked and over the years that we've read this. And sometimes you get so familiar with material that you don't really see what's going on under the surface. So we want to open this up and get to the heart of what is being said. Now, a couple of weeks ago, we spent time in this chapter. We broke up into small groups. And you did an exercise where you looked for the six commandments Yeshua cites from the Torah. Then we looked at how they connect to one another and how Yeshua gave us a fence to protect each of these commandments. And we'll be doing things like that again over the coming weeks. But I want us to back up to what is known as the Beatitudes, which basically means beautiful saying. And these are beautiful. So we'll start in chapter 5 and verse 3. Now, your Bibles may say blessed, or praiseworthy, or fortunate, or contented, or the Dalish Gospels translates it, oh, the gladness. And all of these are good translations of the word that is used here. So I'll use, oh, the gladness. Oh, the gladness of the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Oh, the gladness of those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Oh, the gladness of the humble, for they will inherit the earth. Oh, the gladness of those who hunger and thirst for tzedakah, for they will be satisfied. Oh, the gladness of the compassionate, for they will be shown compassion. Oh, the gladness of the pure of heart, for they will behold God. Oh, the gladness of those who pursue shalom, for they will be called sons of God. Oh, the gladness of those who are pursued on account of tzedakah, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Oh, your gladness, if they insult you and pursue you falsely, speaking all kinds of evil about you for my sake. Be happy and rejoice, because your reward in heaven is great. For so they pursued the prophets who were before you. Now, we're going to look at these in a little bit of detail as we go through, but I have to be honest, there's something that's always puzzled me about these Beatitudes. In fact, there are several things that have puzzled me over the years. And one of the main ones is, why did Yeshua begin his teaching with the Beatitudes? They seem more appropriate at the end of the teaching rather than at the beginning. In fact, you could take these Beatitudes and plug them in just about anywhere in the sermon and it'd be appropriate. Why did he start with these? Normally, when a person does a teaching, then at the end, they'll do a blessing over the people who are listening. But Yeshua puts it right up at the front. So what you can do is you can read the sermon and save the Beatitudes and put them right at the very end, and it'll just be perfectly appropriate. You'll notice it seems to be fine to do it that way. You can put them at the front, and it's okay there. What's going on here? Well, remember last week as we looked at those six commandments, I'm sorry, 2 weeks ago, we looked at those six commandments Yeshua quotes, he picks them out of the Torah. We saw how each commandment leads to the next, and to the next, and to the next. So what happens when you get to number six? It leads you right back to number one. You know, in Greek thought, in Western thought, the way we were raised in school, everything's very linear. We want to make timelines. We want to have a beginning and a middle and an end. But in Hebraic thought, the way the Jewish mind works and the way the writers of the Bible work, the way Messiah's mind works, things are in a circle. I should say a spiral. This is why we circle through the Torah year after year after year. And as we do so, we spiral up. And you're going to find over and over again that in the scriptures, things are this circular reasoning. It's not circular reasoning in the negative sense, but circular thought, where things always bring you back to the beginning. Because in God's mind, everything is together as one. There's not a beginning, a middle, and an end. In his mind, it's all one. And only a circle can take you through that entire kind of a process. There's a wonderful story. Many of you know this, and if you've heard me share it before, I apologize. You're just going to have to hear it again. But there's a legend, and I love these legends because they have so much to teach. There's a legend that when God called Moses up on Mount Sinai, he gave him the entire Torah from Genesis to Deuteronomy, the entire thing. And he gave it to him as a scroll that went all the way around in one complete circle. So here's Moses in the middle, and everywhere he looked, he saw this scroll from Genesis to Deuteronomy all the way around him. And God says, here's my Torah. I want you to take it down and give it to the children of Israel. And Moses says, well, how do I carry this? Then God gave him a knife and says, just go over and just slice it somewhere. Just slice it and then roll it up and then you can carry it. And Moses says, well, where should I slice it? He says, anywhere you want. So Moses went and he started reading, trying to figure out where to slice it. And he started reading. He read all the way through. He could not find any place where there's the break in the continuity of this amazing revelation of God's heart and mind. He says, God, I don't know where to slice it. He says, okay, just close your eyes, spin in a circle, stick out the knife, and that'll be fine. So Moses closes his eyes, spins in a circle, sticks out the knife, and he slices it between what we know as the end of Deuteronomy and the beginning of Genesis. And you know, if you take the end of Deuteronomy and the beginning of Genesis and stick them together, it reads like this: and for the sake of all the mighty power and all the great deeds of all that Moses did in the sight of all Israel, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. In other words, why did God create the heavens and the earth? So he could play out the story of redemption that we find in the story of Moses and Israel in Egypt. In fact, the Bible, the book of Genesis, begins with Bet, the second letter of the alphabet. There's another legend where all the letters came, you know, and they said, God, start the Torah with me. And he decides to start with Bet. And along comes Aleph, the first letter of the alphabet, says, why don't you start it with me? He says, I have special plans for you. I'm starting the creation with a second letter of the alphabet, but when I give my Ten Commandments, where it says, Ani Adonai, I am the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, I will start that with Aleph. Because the creation serves the secondary purpose of me giving my Torah to my people. And that's the primary purpose for creation. So we can look at the Torah like this. This letter here on the left is the letter Bet. And it is the first letter of Genesis. Genesis 1:1, Bereshit, in the beginning. And if you go all the way through the Torah, all the way to the very end, that last verse in Deuteronomy ends in the letter Lamed. And these two letters together spell the word Lev, which means heart. Because you see, the Torah is a revelation of God's heart. It's one whole. It's one whole connected thing. Yeshua's sermon here on the hillside is a revelation of God's Torah. And the sages and the rabbis all through the years have said, when the Messiah comes, he will reveal the heart of the Torah. Messiah has come. And it's exactly what he's done. He's revealed the heart of the Torah through his teachings and his deeds and his life, and focused here in the Sermon on the Mount. He's revealing the heart of the Torah. And again, 2 weeks ago, as we looked at these commandments that he chose, these six commandments, as he told us how to build a fence around each one and how they connect, you're looking into the heart of what God's mind is. Our Messiah is revealing God's heart. And so the Torah is a revelation of God's heart and mind. Now, Messiah tells us that the mouth speaks out of that which fills the heart. Right? God has given us his Torah. So where does the Torah come from? God's heart. And people who foolishly proclaim that God's done away with his Torah, then that means God has done away with his heart. His heart has changed. He's not the same God. And you know what? If God changes, I need to find me a better God. But the word says, there in Hebrews, he's the same yesterday, today, and forever. He is eternal. He is the rock. He does not change. That means his word does not change. It does not pass away. And just as the Torah is in God's heart, it needs to be in ours. In Deuteronomy 6:6, now we proclaim the Shema. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. And these words I command you today shall be on your heart. And then Yeshua quotes Deuteronomy and he says, it is written, man shall not live by bread alone. Now God spoke forth the creation, right? And from eating from the creation, we keep our bodies alive. He says, but we also live by every word that comes from the mouth of God. And what comes out of God's mouth? What is in his heart? Because out of the mouth, the heart speaks. And the Torah is God's heart. Do you understand? God's word, what is in his heart, became flesh and dwelt among us. And Messiah was still proclaiming who God is by living out his Torah, filling it out, showing us what it looks like when it's lived out as a human being. That's an amazing concept. And I know many of us have gotten past this dichotomy of thinking Yeshua taught one thing and the Torah teaches another. And the more we begin to see that they teach one and the same thing, one is the outside, one's the inside, they go together. When we begin to see that more and more, the lights start going on. The circuits connect. One more verse about this, Proverbs 4:4. He taught me and said to me, let your heart hold fast my words. Keep my commandments and live. A lot of people have Torah in their heads, like the Pharisees, the scribes, and a lot of people I know today. But they don't have it in their hearts. And the new covenant is all about God writing his Torah on our hearts. Jeremiah 31:31. He says, I'll make a new covenant with the house of Israel, with Judah, and I will write my Torah, the same Torah, on their hearts. And that's an exciting thing that's happening. It's taking place. You know, my son Josh and I, we were out the other day. And we were talking, and he says, boy, human beings sure can get fouled up, can they? And we were talking about dumb decisions people make and how people can so ruin their lives. And like I've said so many times to you, I was sharing it with him, I says, you know, nobody needs to teach a dog how to be a dog. Nobody has to teach an elephant how to be an elephant or a bird how to be a bird. Human beings must be taught how to be a human being. We're made in God's image, which means that not just on the outside, but the inside, there's a correspondence between us and him. And if we don't have what's on his heart and our hearts, we will fail as human beings. We will not live a successful human life. So God has given us an owner's manual called the Torah. And all the rest of the Bible illuminates and comments on the Torah. And if we follow the handbook and align our lives, our actions, our words, our thoughts with what's in the Torah, we will live successful lives as human beings. It's the handbook on how to be a human being. I want to be a human being. But if you don't have the Torah, then what you want to do is become an animal. And some people do. Or you want to become an angel. And who can stand a human being who thinks they're an angel? You ever met people who are so spiritual, they just kind of make you want to vomit? That's not my illustration, that's Yeshua's. Because people who want to be an animal or be an angel and excuse it by using his word, these are people who are lukewarm. What we are is the place where the physical and the spiritual unite, where they come together, where they totally connect. And to do that, we must feed our bodies, so the things God's created for that, and we live by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God, and that we're healthy physically and spiritually. The two stay connected, and we are a human being in the best sense of the word. It's a lifetime process. There's no question about that. At least for me, it is. Now, the other question that comes to mind is, what are these Beatitudes all about? Why does he pick out these particular, it depends on how you count them. Some people say there are eight, or you could say there are nine, because the last one about persecution is repeated. So eight Beatitudes, nine Beatitudes, depends on how you count them. What are they all about? Here's the answer. I think I got this from Daniel Lancaster. I don't remember. But they describe the characteristics of the citizens of heaven. Let's go through these for a moment. All you have to do is take the opposites of what the Beatitudes are. Oh, the gladness of the poor in spirit. This means people who are humble, who realize they're needy. They realize they don't have it all together yet. If you're a person who realizes you just don't have it together yet, you're poor in spirit. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Now, what's the opposite of that? Somebody who says, I got it all together. Well, theirs is not the kingdom of heaven. Is there anybody who claims they've got it all together? Is blind as a bat. Which turns out, science has discovered aren't all that blind after all. But anyway. The gladness of those who mourn, they'll be comforted. How about the people who are so hard-hearted, they don't mourn over anything? They don't let anything bother them. Well, there's no comfort in their future. Oh, the gladness of the humble, they'll inherit the earth. What did the proud inherit? They inherit the wind. Oh, the gladness of those who hunger and thirst for tzedakah. Now, that word tzedakah, I don't translate because it has three basic meanings. The literal word meaning of the word tzedakah is the word righteousness. Okay, and that most Bibles translate it that way. It also means charity. And the word tzedakah is used in that way a little later on in chapter 6, where Yeshua says, guard yourselves from doing your tzedakah before sons of men to be seen of them. Verse 2, so when you do tzedakah, don't blast a shofar in front of you like hypocrites. Verse 3, but as for you when you do tzedakah, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your tzedakah will be in secret. What is used here is charity. You know, in the box that on the stand back there is called the tzedakah box. We don't take up offerings here at Beth Dakun. If you want to drop something in the box, it will go to help support missions and people and things. About 20% goes to help keep Beth Dakun running. But the other 80% goes out to help people who are in need. Tzedakah, charity. So he's saying, those who hunger and thirst after charity, you're going to get it. But it also means vindication. And it's used that way later in the Sermon on the Mount as well, actually right here. I think sometimes, do you ever wonder where justice is in the world? Where the justice is? Because you see people who are in positions of power, maybe you work for one, and it seems like it's so unfair. It's like, when's there going to be, where's the justice? And sometimes people who are doing things so right, they suffer. Where's the justice? God says it's coming. It's all coming. But the word tzedakah also just means righteousness, just being righteous. And do you hunger to be a righteous person? I hunger for all these. I want vindication. I want to see justice in the world. I want to be a righteous person. And there are times that I need charity and I hunger and thirst for charity for others, so I see a need. And God says, you'll all get it. It'll come. Well, how about for those who don't? They'll never be satisfied. Oh, the gladness of the compassionate. They receive compassion. How about the ones who aren't compassionate? They don't. There's a saying in Judaism which I love. It says, if you become compassionate to the wicked, you will eventually become wicked to the compassionate. We need to be very careful. Sometimes the best compassion you can show to a wicked person is to withhold. We need to be very careful with this. But I've watched believers treat other believers like dirt. But there's so much sinner out there who's suffering or just being mean and hard-hearted, and they'll just go lavish all kinds of love and grace on them. I'm thinking, something's backwards. And I'm just putting this thought there for you to think. Be careful of what I'm saying, all right? But I'm telling you something could be a little dangerous, because I don't want you to harden your hearts and think, oh, they're mean, I'm going to be loving and gracious to them. What I'm saying is you must be loving and gracious to them, but sometimes love and grace towards a truly wicked person means standing back and waiting a while before you give it. God operates this way, but it takes incredible wisdom and sensitivity to do it just right. So let's try to get it right. Let's try to get it right. Oh, the gladness of the pure in heart, they'll behold God. Well, how about the impure in heart? They won't see God. Oh, the gladness of those who pursue peace, they'll be called sons of God. But what happens if you call yourself a child of God, but you're sowing discord among your brothers? Guess what? You're not going to be called a son of God. Probably be called Satan's little helper instead. Oh, the gladness of those who are pursued. Now, pursued means persecute, but in Hebrew, they use the term pursue. Those who are chasing after, trying to get those who are doing what's right. Those who are persecuted or pursued on account of tzedakah, of being a righteous person, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Oh, your gladness that they insult you and pursue you. I can't tell you how many times people have come to me and they're just so upset, so hurt because, you know, they're trying to do the right thing and somebody at work is giving them a hard time and doing this and this. And I say, I almost want to say, what's wrong with you? Don't you see? You're supposed to be rejoicing. Have you done anything wrong at work? But no, I know of. Are you trying to be a model Messiah in front of people? You're trying to be loving and gracious to people? Yeah, I'm really trying to do that. Well, then be happy for Pete's sake. This is a badge of honor. This is the way they treated the prophets, the way they treated Yeshua. And God's allowing you to experience what they experienced. So what are you so blue about? Now, there's a warning attached to this as well. I know a lot of people call themselves believers, and they're always being persecuted, and they deserve it. Because they think persecution is a badge they wear because they are so righteous. You've met those? Yeah. And they're boasting about how they suffer for the cause of Christ. Like, no, that's not happening. That just isn't happening. You're just getting what you deserve. We need to be careful that the persecution we get, we need to look at it. First of all, look at ourselves and think, all right, do I deserve this? And maybe the answer is yes. If that's the case, this is God's teacher trying to point out to you something you need to correct in your life. All right? But if you know, honestly, in your heart, it's something you don't deserve, then don't be surprised. Don't be surprised. And instead, rejoice, because God has counted you worthy to bear some of the sufferings of Messiah. That's a great honor. We shouldn't go out seeking that. But when it comes, don't be surprised, and don't start moaning, all right? In fact, he spends two verses on this, three actually. Verse 10 again, oh, the gladness of those who are pursued on account of tzedakah, righteousness, for theirs the kingdom of heaven. Oh, your gladness that they insult you and pursue you falsely. Make sure that it's falsely. Where they pursue you falsely, speaking all kinds of evil about you for my sake, be happy and rejoice, because your reward in heaven is great. For so they pursued the prophets who were before you. Now, if you have the Delitzsch Hebrew Gospels, if you look over at the Hebrew side, you'll know that each of these verses starts with this word, Ashrei. There it is right there, Ashrei. Ashrei can be translated contented, happy, praiseworthy. Most Orthodox translations translate it praiseworthy, glad, fortunate, and there are probably a bunch of other words that translate this one Hebrew word. It's an amazing Hebrew word. And in fact, there's one of the tribes, one of the 12 tribes, is named Asher, which means happy. It comes from this verse, Genesis 30, 12 to 13. Leah's servant Zilpah bore Jacob a second son. And Leah said, happy am I, for daughters have called me happy. So she called his name Happy. Sounds like one of the seven dwarves, I know. But that's what Asher means. Happy, praiseworthy, fortunate, contented. Here's the verse in Hebrew. And I put Asher in red each time. Votomer Leah. And Leah said, Be'ashrei ki ashruni. There's Asher a second time. Banot v'tikra et shemo Asher. Asher. You see it three times. happy. She's rejoicing. And Asherah holds all of these meanings. Now, as we go through this, these Beatitudes, if you analyze them, I think you'll find that they're divided into three groups. And remember I was telling you how the Torah makes a complete circle? And how the Sermon on the Mount makes a complete circle? How the six commandments, Yeshua, we analyzed a couple weeks ago, they make a complete circle? Even the Beatitudes make a complete circle. Look at the first Beatitude. What does it say? Blessed or oh, the gladness of the poor in spirit, for theirs is the what? Kingdom of heaven. So what does the last Beatitude say? Verse 10. Oh, the gladness of those who are persecuted on account of Tzedakah, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. See how it makes a complete circle? You're going to notice circles a lot in Yeshua's teaching. This theme of the eternal circle. Everything connecting back to the beginning again. But if we look at these Beatitudes, something that struck me is that they do group into three groupings. The first four, blessed are the poor in spirit. This is internal. This is internal. You just feel like, oh, I'm just not doing well enough. I need to do better. I need to just grow closer to God. I need to be more the man or the woman I need to be. Those who mourn. Mourning's an internal emotion, something you suffer internally. The humble or the humiliated, in Hebrew it's the same thing. This is an internal thing again. It's an internal, something you feel and you suffer inside. Those who hunger and thirst after Tzedakah, hunger and thirst, it's an internal thing. See how all four of these have to do with our inner longings. The inner person, the emotions deep down. Something you just, you have this ache. But then the next three have to do with behavior. It says, blessed are the compassionate. Compassion is something you do. It's something you show. Blessed are the pure in heart. And you might think, well, that's internal. We'll come to that in just a second. Come back to that. Those who make peace is something you do. This is a behavior. Now, this pure in heart, at first you think, well, that's not a behavior. Some people are just pure in heart and others aren't. Not true. Children are pure in heart. They're born that way. We adults, we have to work hard to maintain purity in our hearts. We must work daily to maintain that. And we need to protect our children, too, so their hearts stay pure as long as possible. Because there's a dirty world out here, like Bill mentioned earlier. There's a dirty world that wants to come in and pollute our hearts. We need to be careful when we watch a movie. Be ready to hit that off button. When it comes to something. Sometimes you don't know what to expect. Sometimes a movie can surprise you how wonderful it is. Sometimes it can shock you by the direction it takes. Maybe hit that off button. Maybe there's a book. There's some books I've read just a part of, and it's great. You get to something, I can't go any further. Close the book, away it goes. We have to do things to protect the purity of our hearts. This is something you find all through the Scriptures. It's an active, ongoing activity. Just a couple of passages here. I'm going to skip down. Psalm 24, verses 3 to 5. Who shall ascend the hill of the Lord? And who shall stand in his holy place? He who has clean hands and a pure heart. Do you know some people have clean hands, but their hearts are dirty? Right? I think of the Pharisees who had Yeshua crucified. They didn't drive the nails in. Their hands were clean. Now, they had others do the dirty work, but their hearts were impure. Their hearts were dirty. He who has clean hands and a pure heart, who does not lift up his soul to what is false and does not swear deceitfully, he will receive blessing from the Lord and righteousness, tzedakah, from the God of his salvation. But I love this verse in 1 Peter 1:22. This is a good one to memorize. Look what Peter says. Having purified your souls by what? Your obedience to the truth. Stop right there. How many of you thought your souls were made pure because you asked Jesus to come into your life? Or because you confessed your sins? All of these things bring purity and forgiveness. But there's this ongoing work of purifying your soul that comes only through obedience to the truth. Having purified your souls by your obedience to the truth for a sincere brotherly love, love one another earnestly from a pure heart. You cannot love one another earnestly from a pure heart unless you are purifying your souls by your obedience to the truth. So many times people say, well, the Torah has passed away. Love is the fulfillment of the Torah. If you don't have the Torah, you don't know how to love. Love takes wisdom. It takes incredible wisdom. Because if I love my neighbor as I love myself, and I love to bowl, and I give my wife a bowling ball for our anniversary because I'm giving her what I would like, when she hates bowling, you see the problem? Loving your neighbor requires great knowledge and insight into your neighbor. And to understand your neighbor, you need to know the Torah. And we're to love God with all our heart, soul, and strength. To love Him, you have to know what pleases Him. His ways are so different from ours. So to love Him takes wisdom and skill and insight. And then, what if your kids love fireworks? You load them down with M-80s and rockets on their birthday, their eighth birthday. You see, again, love takes skill. Now, this is a pretty obvious one where you don't do this. But again, sometimes love requires withholding. Love is not an easy thing. But sincere love, brotherly love, requires obedience to the truth. Now, what is the truth? Well, the scriptures say over and over again that God's Torah is truth. In fact, in Romans 2:20, I don't know if I put the verse down here or not. Let me just read it to you. Romans 2:20 says this. Speaking of the Torah, Paul writes, talking about the Jewish people, the rabbis being instructors of the foolish, a teacher of children, having in the Torah the embodiment of knowledge and truth. You want knowledge and truth? It's in the Torah. This is why we spend our lives immersing our minds in it and putting it on our hearts. Psalm 119, 142, your righteousness is righteous forever, and your Torah is truth. It is truth. So, going back to these, we see that purity of heart is an activity. It's something we invest our energies in, and our minds and our souls. So, the first four, we have four here, these four are inner longings. And then we have three that have to do with behavior. And then we have the last two, that is how people treat us. It says, blessed are those who are persecuted on account of tzedakah. Blessed are those who are persecuted undeservedly. Two. Four, three, two. They're in three very distinct groups, aren't they? You see it? Got the inner, it's in the spirit. Then you have the outworkings of what you do. And then out there is what you get as payback from the world. So this brings us to another question. Oops. The other question is this. From where did Yeshua derive these three categories? Where did he get these three categories? Now, we'll talk about this more later, but I'm going to drop this out there now for you to be chewing on, thinking about over the coming weeks. The pat answer is, well, Yeshua's God. He just knows it. May I suggest to you, based on Scripture, which says that he grew in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and man, based on passages such as when his disciples ask him, when are you returning? He says, I don't know. Only my Father knows. May I suggest to you, Yeshua didn't know everything, at least not here on earth. In fact, I believe with all my heart, and I believe this for a long time, it wasn't until I heard other teachers who are a lot smarter and better educated than me and closer to God than me say it, that confirmed it, that I feel safe to share it with you. And it's this. I don't think there's one thing Yeshua said or did on earth. That any perfect human being, godly human being, couldn't do or say. Now, he's the only one who did, because he's the only perfect one. But I believe everything he did, even every miracle he worked, every prophecy, every teaching, what you see here is a perfect man and how they truly function. You see, we can read Yeshua's life and look at his words and his actions and think, well, he's God. Of course he can do it, but I can't. No. I think you're missing the point if you say that. Yeshua's saying, no. You can do this too. You can do this too. But it's going to require absolute, total devotion, 100% body, soul, and spirit to following me. And no one, of course, is ever going to achieve the status of Yeshua. Don't get me wrong. But I don't think we're permitted to make the cop-out, well, he's God, therefore he could just do it. No. I think we begin to see everything he said and did and performed and realize he did that in his human capacity as a human being totally devoted to God with an iron control over his own will, who never put anything worthless before his eyes. He never wasted time, but he invested his time in being a disciple of God and following him completely. Only he has done it. He's the only one who ever will. But we have to realize this is what is possible for a human being. Do you follow what I'm saying? I don't feel like I'm putting it very well. But I don't think we should cop out anymore. Say, hey, you can just do it. He's God. No, I think he put all that aside and lived life with all the limitations of a human being and did it perfectly. Yes, Mim, see your hand up. Sure. I think that probably is something, the question Mim asked. By the way, if you're visiting, you're welcome to ask questions. I don't know why everybody's been so quiet. Thank you for breaking the ice, Mim. You can ask questions or share insights. To be in Messiah, I think to a great degree. Because with Messiah, we get a fresh start, but it's only a start. And we're required to do the work of growing up and pursuing him, being a disciple of him. He is our rabbi. I'm not. He's your rabbi. But I think when you begin to look at Yeshua's works and his teachings with this realization, I think it can revolutionize your own life. You're going to expect more of yourselves. You're going to be more devoted. Yes, Jane. Yeah.
Being in him takes a lot of relationship with God.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
There's so many times that we come home from work and we're strained and we don't want to do this, we have the children to deal with and all these possibilities.
Yeah.
God said, oh, slow down.
Yes, right.
Put time up there for me.
Yeah.
And there's lots of times I struggle with things myself as well.
Yeah. Right.
So then relationship
comes back. So I'm not sure if I'm putting that together. I think you are. I think what you're describing is a sheep, and we're all easily distracted from the shepherd. Yeah. We're all very easily distracted. Yeah, very true. I know I am. Well, anyways, going back to the question, where did Yeshua derive these three categories? Now remember, Yeshua was a rabbi with smicha, with authority. He had the entire Torah, the prophets, the writings all memorized. He was a master teacher. He's a master of this. He did it by elbow grease and hard work. I know he was brilliant as well, but he put in the work, he put in the hours to memorize God's word and to meditate on it and to really grasp it with his heart. And everything we see him teaching, you can always find it derived out of the Hebrew scriptures. So, I believe where he derived this was from Psalm 1, verse 1, which starts the word Ashrei. The very first word of the book of Psalms is Ashrei, the same word Yeshua uses at the beginning of each of the Beatitudes. Now think what perfect sense this makes. Matthew wrote his gospel to demonstrate and prove that Yeshua is the son of David, right? And so when Yeshua begins this teaching, which is the foundation and the summation of everything he had to teach, is it only appropriate that he begin it the way David began the only book he wrote, which is the book of Psalms? By the way, just as the Sermon on the Mount is the heart of Torah revealed, did you know the book of Psalms is divided into five sections called the book of Genesis, book of Exodus, book of Leviticus? Even ancient rabbis have done this, and some of your Bibles may even show these indications. I think Psalms 1 to 41 make up the Genesis book of Psalms. Even the book of Psalms is divided up into five separate books named after the five books of the Torah. Isn't that interesting? So the Psalms is David's take on the Torah, where he prays at the Torah, talks about living it out, the challenges he has as a fallen human being, a failed human being. And then here comes Yeshua, the son of David, but the perfect son, the king of the Jews, the son of God. And he begins his teaching with the same word that David begins his. And Psalm 1:1 says, Ashrei ha'ish, Ashrei, contented, happy, fortunate, blessed is the man who, and look what he does, walks not in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers or scorners. Do you see the three divisions? The first one has to do with the internals. In fact, the word for counsel is only used twice in the Torah. The first time it's used, it means spine. Let's talk about the sacrifices. You take the spine of the animal. It's the internal. It's the internal strength. It's the internal motivation. It's the thing that's internal that holds everything else together. And for one who is wicked, his spine is wickedness. And we're not to walk in his counsel. You got it? Yes?
It's just been rolling around in my head that in evangelical pools of Christianity, they've seemed to have taken the word wicked and made it synonymous with unbeliever.
Oh, I know.
And, yeah. And so as you're saying this, I can't help but bells going off in my head that are kind of confusing.
Yeah. Well, we can't do that. We have to... The word in Hebrew is the word rasha, and plural is rashaim. It says, blessed are the ones who don't walk in the counsel of the rashaim. So what we need to do, you go back and look how rasha is used. It's only used for particular kinds of people. Okay? And just to say, well, that means unbeliever. No. I think it can apply to some believers I know. All right? In fact, the demons all believe and they tremble. So, I think we have to go back and redefine words according to how they're used in the scriptures. Yeah. Does that make sense? Okay. That's a good question, Ted. But this word counsel is only used twice in the Torah. The first time means spine, and the other time is over in Deuteronomy, and it means counsel. And it talks about a nation who walk in, they embrace wrong counsel. But then we have stands in the way of sinners. So this is something you do. Sin is something that's done. This first one, wicked, that's an internal thing. But then look at the third one, scoffers. What was the third group of the Beatitudes? Persecuted on account of Zadaka. Persecuted undeservedly. Who's doing the persecuting? The scoffers, the scorners. You see the three groups again? So let's put it together. The Beatitudes start with the same word that Psalms begins with. And the very first verse of Psalms talks about the blessing that comes to a person who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked. You know, sometimes when people come to me, they're trying to say, where should I go to get counseling? They start sharing how they've gone to different psychiatrists and the worldly psychologists and so on. Now, I'm not against psychology. That's a science. Psychiatry is black magic. It's witchcraft as far as I'm concerned. And people, it's just my opinion, my humble opinion. But people, psychiatrists don't believe there is a spirit. They don't even believe we have spirits. They believe we're just animals basically evolved from monkeys or whatever. So why, if I've got a spiritual problem, go to someone who's not going to give me spiritual counsel? And if I do walk in their counsel, my blessing is removed. Blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, the ungodly person. You follow? We need to be very careful whose counsel we embrace. Consider the source. And notice this. I love this. Look what David does. You start by walking. Then you stop walking, you just stand. And finally, you just plop down and sit. I love what Charles Spurgeon said. He says, it says, the seat of the scoffer may be very lofty, but it's very near the gates of hell. I love that. So we need to be careful what we walk in, because eventually we'll stand there and finally we'll just sit down and we'll never move again. We need to be very careful what counsel we walk in. But then this leads us to another question. Where did David derive these three categories? David was a student of what? Of the Torah. Now, where in the Torah do we find these three categories listed? Deuteronomy 6:5. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart. That's the internal part of you. Levav. Remember how the Torah begins? The letter Beit ends with Lamed. It spells the word Lev. Well, the full spelling of Lev is the word Levav. And with all your soul. Now, the word used there is nefesh. According to the Hebrew scriptures, the soul has two sides, the nefesh and the neshama. And think about yourself. Your soul is your mind, your will, your emotions. That's what's going on inside. What's going on behind your eyeball, so to speak. All right? What's going on in there? You got a mind that's always thinking. You have a will that's always deciding. You have emotions that are always feeling. It's always going on inside us all the time. Even when we're asleep, it's going on. Well, that thing going on inside of you has two sides. One side of your soul, the neshama, is very interested in the spiritual things. What does happen to me when I die? What are the consequences of this wise action or foolish action? What is my relationship with God like? What is my relationship with people like? Am I wise? Do I really understand things? Should I spend more time being quiet, meditating on God's word? That's what the neshama does. That's what its mind, will, and emotions are geared toward. The nefesh is the other side of the soul. It's interested in the physical. Did I remember to brush my teeth this morning? Should I eat this fourth helping of coconut cream pie? You know, should I go to the gym today? Should I dress a little warmer? Those kinds of things. Because it's not that one's good, one's bad. It's just that one's concerned with the physical welfare of your body. The other's concerned with the spiritual welfare of your soul. And these make the two sides. Well, when Moses gives this, when God speaks to Moses, you'll love Adonai God with all your heart. This is all the inner things going on. But then with your nefesh, just means with what's going on physically in your life. And then with all of your me'edeka. This, you know, some say strength, some say might. In fact, when this verse is quoted in the New Testament, it says, with all your might, with all your strength. They use two Greek words to try to translate this word mo'ed, or ma'od, not mo'ed, ma'od. See, the word ma'od just simply means very, V-E-R-Y. If something's very good, you say it's tov mod. If something's very bad, you say it's ra mode. Okay? It just means very. Well, it doesn't translate very well. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your varies. You know, what does that mean? Well, your varies are the things that make you you. Some of you, Bill is very good at PR and the things he does at his job. I'm lousy at that. And then you got Rob Horger's great at, you know, crunching numbers and keeping the book straight. I hate that sort of thing. I'd like to see Rob's checkbook. Not to see how much money is there, but just, I bet everything is just printed. I bet none of the letters touch the lines, you know. It's all just so neat. I bet it'd be suitable for framing, if you could see. And other people, they're very good at this or very good at that. We all are very good at many things. Often we don't give ourselves credit for. But these are the things you love God with. What are the gifts He's given you? The abilities, the aptitudes. Love Him with all of those. So it starts with the inside, the spirit, deep in the heart. It has to do with the body. Then all the things project out from it. You still see the same three areas from the inside out. You see it? Yes, Jeff.
I heard something that helped me one time, maybe it will help somebody else, that man is body, soul, and spirit. And the only part that's reborn when we come to Christ is the spirit. And this is the body and the soul we're struggling with this being.
Yeah. Well, you bring up a great point. Jeff, for those of you who can't hear it on the microphone, was talking about how the Bible talks about the body, soul, and spirit. Actually, it puts it in another order, spirit, soul, body. It starts at the inside out. And Paul writes at the end of Thessalonians, either 1st or 2nd Thessalonians. I never remember the 1st or the 2nd. So this is right there in the last couple of verses of one of them. And he prays that God will preserve your entire spirit and soul and body. And what's interesting, and we'll hit this somewhere down the road as we go through Matthew. When you take all the verses that talk about salvation, guess what? You can put them in three categories. There are some verses, and it doesn't always come through in the English translations, but some verses talk about how we have been saved, past tense. There are verses talk about how we as believers are being saved. Then there are other verses that talk about how we as believers will be saved. You find some that are past tense, some in the present tense, some in the future tense. Again, these don't always come out in the English translations. Most of them do. But you might have to do a little digging. But we'll get into this more. What's interesting about these, though, when you see about the ones that have been saved, if there's any information given at all, it's about the spirit, the internal, the spirit of the person. The ones that have to do about how we will be saved all have to do with the body. In fact, in Romans 8, it talks about how the whole creation groans and travails at it now, awaiting for the revelation of the sons of God, namely the redemption of our bodies. And someday we get a new body. But during the lifetime we have here, guess what is being saved? Our souls. For us to say, my soul has been saved, is theologically incorrect. To say, my soul is in the process of being saved, is the way it should be. This is why Peter tells the believers, says, to desire the sincere miracle of the word that is saving your souls. It's able to save your souls. It's an ongoing process. Let me describe it this way before you all start picking up pitchforks and torches. Salvation is a process that begins at a moment in time. When we encounter God, we begin to give our lives to Him. It's like His Shekinah comes down into our Holy of Holies. We spend a lifetime as a disciple, as a learner, growing, obeying His word, and taking every area of our soul, every area of our mind, every area of our will, every area of our emotions, and submitting it to the lordship of His word. Those areas in your soul that you do not submit to His lordship, those are parts of your soul that bear no fruit, they remain in darkness, and when you stand before Him, you'll suffer loss for those. Scripture is very clear that some people in heaven suffer loss. We're like the servant that took a talent, and we didn't invest it, we just buried it and gave it back. We didn't use it. It didn't grow. And it's taken away from him. You follow what I'm saying? So it's, I know my experience in my life, every once in a while, not so much anymore, I think I've sort of learned my lesson. Every once in a while I'll start thinking, Grant, we get it together. You're not half as bad as you used to be. You're doing pretty good. Then all of a sudden God comes knocking on some door of my life I didn't even know was there. And I hear the knock and I look at that, oh, I don't want him going in there. He says, you either let me in there, that part of you is lost forever. But you let me in there, that part of your soul, your mind, your will, whatever it is, I can begin to use it, invest it in my kingdom. But I don't want you in there. And there's a struggle. They finally open the door. Okay. And then I start thinking, Grant, you're doing pretty good. You got it together. And then in that room, there's another door. And then in that room, there's another door. It seems like it's never over. And you begin to realize how complex we are, and there are doors of our souls we have not yet opened and submitted to Him. But we have one lifetime to get her done. You follow? So salvation of the soul is a lifetime process, and then someday we get new bodies. And in Revelation 12, you hear the angels say, now is come salvation. Now it's finally arrived. Now it's finally complete. But it's a long process. Okay? So thanks for the question, Jeff. That helped fill. I was wondering how we're going to fill up that last 5 or 10 minutes there. But Adam, I see your hand up. Yes? Yeah. Yes. Good point. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Good point. I wish I could summarize and repeat that for the people who are listening on the internet, but I can't. But you remind me, what you said, it reminds me so much of something I read by Watchman Nee years ago. It really made an impact on me. He says, we make the mistake of looking at certain people in the world and think, oh, well, they're just so, oh, pick something. They're just so courageous. They're so, let's pick some kind of a, attribute. They're such good speakers. If only they give their life to the Lord, they could. God could use them so much to speak to people. Not necessarily. Not unless they take their speaking ability, submit it to Him, and learn how to shut up when He wants them not to talk. You see? We see other people, oh, they're so filled with joy. They just bring happiness and light up the room whenever they come. That'd be wonderful if they became believers. Maybe. But they need to learn how to weep with those who weep. I've had to learn to weep with those who weep. I've learned what a bonehead I've been. Sometimes somebody's really grieving. I come up and just start yucking it up with them. Oh, you know, let me tell you this. Try to, and it's like, it's just, and I know from reading Proverbs, it's destructive and agonizing when you do that. You need to weep with those who weep. We look at someone who has some attribute that's a positive attribute, but unless that attribute is submitted to God, that attribute could be the very thing that makes them ineffective. That person is such a lion, they need to be a believer, not unless they also learn how to be a lamb. You follow? That person is so meek, they'd make a wonderful believer, not unless they learn to be a lion when they're called upon to roar. We need to submit even the good things to Him so they come under His lordship and into balance. Jim, I see your hand up.
One's heart has to be right, of course, but listening closely to all the traits and attributes, it's more an effort for you to see that those around you and those that you know develop them more importantly than you develop.
Yes. Yeah. We look upon the things of others and, yeah. Our lives only have meaning to the degree we pour them out to others, lay them down for others. The only meaning you'll have in your life is the way you serve other people. And if you're not laying down your life for the sake of others, your life has no meaning, except for the example God will make of you of what not to be. Robin, I saw your hand up.
Yeah. And then when I go to God, sometimes you withhold the word of yourself, thinking let me down. Yeah. And you reserve a part of you thinking that you're doing yourself a favor, and you sabotage our intimacy with him and with other people because we think that wholeheartedness is dangerous.
Yeah.
But God says, if you really trust who I am, you will love me with all your fears.
Yeah, that's right. Self-preservation is just a slow suicide we commit. Self-preservation is building a fortress around you, but everyone else sees it as a jail cell. There's no difference between a fortress and a jail cell except which side is the key lock, which side of the door is the lock on. I'm reminded of a dear, dear friend, love him to death, a great, great guy. And we were talking one day on the phone. And his father was in very poor health. His dad is just an incredible man. Great, great guy. Godly man. Great example. And his father's in poor health, and he was concerned that maybe his dad's getting ready to pass away. And he asked me, he says, Grant, what do I do to prepare for this? I said, in other words, you want to protect your heart from hurting. He says, yeah. I says, nothing. You just let it hurt. It's going to hurt. That's how you go through it. You hurt, you just let it kind of rip your heart out, and you go through it, you'll survive it, and you go on with life. But what are you going to do in the meantime? You're going to try to love your dad less so it doesn't hurt so bad? And this applies to everything. If we are not willing to completely give ourselves away like Yeshua did, then we're not his disciples. Self-protection, self-preservation is suffocating to yourself. It deadens your soul. And we just need to get over it. If you're afraid of being hurt, well, get over it. Don't be afraid. Just hurt and go on through it. Just absorb the pain. Sometimes I'll tell people you just have to absorb the pain and go through. I see a hand up, I see the hand on the clock. It's going past. I just want to summarize this real quick, and we'll talk during ONAG, okay? So to sum these up, working now from the front of the Bible towards the back, in Deuteronomy 6:5, we're commanded to love God with all of our heart, with all of our nephesh. This is the body side of the soul. And I guess you could say with all of our varies, all of our output. Then in Psalm 1, based upon this verse, David writes in the very first verse of Psalms, to avoid walking in the counsel of the wicked, wicked counsel, which comes out of their heart, comes out of their spine. And don't stand in the way of the sinners. Don't do what sinners do. And don't sit in the seat of the scorners. Don't let your output be one of mockery towards the righteous and towards good things. And then Yeshua, in the Beatitudes, he addresses four of them to the longings of the heart. He addresses three of them to the actions. And then he talks about two, saying, don't be surprised at the treatment you get from this lot up here. Causes pain. He says, rejoice if you get that. You see how it works? Layer upon layer upon layer. Circles within circles. Wheels within wheels. God's word is wonderful. And so as we continue to go through the Sermon on the Mount, we're going to see more of the patterns. And I hope it begins to open up more and more to you. And you'll never look at this teaching of Yeshua in the same way again. So here's some homework for you for next week. Next week we'll be talking just about two things. Salt and light. And what I want you to do, of course, read the scriptures on these, but I want you to get a science book out. Go to Wikipedia. Start reading about salt. Salt has two characteristics. It's made of two elements. Look at what those elements are and what they do and how they operate. Sodium chloride, sodium and chlorine. Learn about sodium and chlorine. Light has two facets. You might want to look at light, new discoveries on light. And and when Yeshua wrote these things, none of his listeners knew what we know about salt and light. We live in an amazing time where we can see into salt and light things that are there in Yeshua's teaching, but were not obvious to the people. But science has now opened up to us. So it should be a lot of fun next week as we look into these two things. As soon as we're done here, you're all invited to come down to the ONEG room and celebrate with food with Ariel Torgler, who had her bat mitzvah this morning. And come down and wish her well, congratulate her, and come and join us and celebrate. So let's close in prayer. Our Father and King, we thank you so much for your blessings, your goodness, and just the riches of wisdom you've provided to us. Lord, in the parable of the master to servants, he gives his servants not lead, not rocks. He gives them gold to invest. And we know that what makes up our soul is pure gold. The talents you give us are pure gold. The abilities and aptitudes you give us, Lord, are wealthy, rich beyond our imagination. So, Father, may we invest them and use them. Take risks with them, Lord, as we invest them in your kingdom. So that when we do stand before you, we will not stand before you empty-handed. But, Father, we'll have a return on our investment. Help us not be self-protective, but, Lord, to pour our souls out for one another, regardless of what happens in return. May we abandon ourselves to you and to one another. We ask this for the sake of your kingdom, in Yeshua's name. Amen.